and they put him behind a curtain, and they said either tonight or tomorrow I'll be taking a different ladder. In Auschwitz, anybody who was really, really sick, which take the recuperation would take a few weeks, immediately into the gas chamber. I fell asleep. What I do remember, that eventually my father came and was sitting there near me, because he kept on saying, Nissen, I should wake up. But I was at such a high fever, and I felt so bad that, like, I mean, you can say, like a delirium. Just opened up my eyes, and I closed it immediately, but I saw my father. And he was sitting there till 10 o'clock. 10 o'clock in Auschwitz, the lights were closed. So the SS comes into this barrack where the doctors were, and I was behind this curtain on a stretcher. And the SS tells my father that now you must leave. A few minutes before 10 o'clock, because 10 o'clock the lights are going on. So my father gives a big shout, calls my name, and opened up my eye. I looked at him, but I couldn't speak. What did I see? That he had tears were rolling down his cheek. And the SS just shouted, he must leave. When you go to, you see the Rebbe. When you go out from the Rebbe's, when you had an audience, still in time, and we could have an audience with the Rebbe, Yechidus with the Rebbe, a person, when he went to the Rebbe, when he walked out, he didn't turn with his back and walk to the door. He just go back, always facing the Rebbe. This I also remember, I had my eyes open, my father was crying, and I was walking back, but the whole time his face turning towards me, facing me, I should see me. And since then, I never saw my father again. Then I was taken into a different lager. I was taken to Lager F. And you know, Lager F was the Lager F in Auschwitz, which Mengele, he was also a doctor. There he made all his medical experimentations. He had a lager with twins. There's a lager full with twins, and also with dwarfs. He wanted to find out how can you cause women should have more than one child. Because Mengele was afraid, and the government of Germany was afraid, that if the war would drag on much longer, as it is, they lost over 10 million soldiers dead. If the war will drag on much longer, the German male population will be depleted, and they're afraid of danger what for the future of Germany. So they wanted to find out, how can you make that a woman should have at once not only one child, she have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 children. So on this, Mengele was making these experimentations on twins. So the whole colony of twins. He also had a colony of little midgets, little dwarfs. I thought the dwarfs you can only find in a circus. And in circus you see this little putz, little. In Auschwitz saw Chassidische Yidden with beards. A whole family, grandparents, parents, children, beards, payers, such little people. I couldn't imagine that, but among millions of Yidden you find all kinds of things. You can find even these little dwarfs in Auschwitz, in this Lager F. And I was there in this Lager F. As I was laying the whole time, there was a doctor from Czechoslovakia, from Prague, and I sent communications. I wrote a letter and I sent it to my father through this doctor, and the communication was going on back and forth with my father and myself. I was in Lager F, he was in Lager D, and this doctor went once a day to the Lager. So I was in a continuous communication with my father. One day, Mengele comes in with his whole group of other medical, he had a medical team, all officers, generals, high officers, who made him with his medical experimentations. And Mengele looks around and he sees me. Every child in Auschwitz he recognized, because he was making with them experimentations, all these experiments. Me, he sees there. And he didn't see me. So he asks the couple, who is this person? Who is this person? This child. So he says, yes, Shalach. Shalach means a scarlet fever. So immediately, he saw the child, an experiment. He points over to me, Arunter, come down. I wanted to show, he shouldn't think that I'm weak, because I'm weak, immediately go to the gas chamber. I was there in this barrack, in Lager Ebb, which is the hospital barracks, only two tiers. I didn't walk down, I just jumped down to show that I'm strong. And he looks at me from top to bottom, looks, then he says to another doctor, tell the couple should bring a stretcher. He brings a stretcher, he tells me I should lay down on this stretcher. Mengele. I lay down on the stretcher, and he says to the other doctors in German, he's going to make on me an experiment. The veins which come from the heart, which go up to the brain, there are a couple of these veins which go spread out to right and left side here and go to the brain. He wants to put an injection in one of the veins. He says as follows. If he'll catch this vein, he'll be able to put the needle into this vein, I'll also be paralyzed for the rest of my life. If he won't be, but just wants to find out whether he can find this vein. If not, I'll be on the spot. I'll be finished on the spot. And he speaks in German to me, to the other doctors, the experiment you're going to make on me. Guinea pig, like you make in the laboratory in frogs. So we were just, in other words, either I'll die on the spot or be paralyzed for the rest of my life. He speaks in German. I don't know whether he knew that I understand German or not, but I would rather venture to say he couldn't care less. He could not care less you can't imagine what we were in the eyes of all this. You know, he's called the angel of death, Mengele. But by every SS, by every German, we were absolutely of no significance, no life, sanctity of life. Who can speak of sanctity of life? We were nothing. So he speaks, and thinking that I just lay there like a little sheep, and I won't react. But I hear this from him, from Mengele. I jump up from my stretcher. I burst out crying. And I really scream at Mengele and I tell him, experiments on monkeys, not on me. And I give a scream at Mengele again and again, experiments on monkeys, not on me. And I jump up back to my bed. If you just ask people who Mengele wasn't used, anybody should defy his will. Anybody should speak back to him. People were afraid to look at him. You just cannot imagine the terror which he put in our hearts, in everybody. Anybody, Mengele should say something, of course everybody just accepts it. Anybody should say a word, and yet now shout at him, scream at him. Mengele became white, that's my shirt, looked at other generals, looked at me again, without any reaction. Ask anybody who was in Auschwitz. Ask anybody who knew this angel of death, what would Mengele do, how would he react, what would he do in such a situation if somebody should not listen to him, someone should shout at him, scream at him, and say, I will not do it. He didn't do anything, just looked at me several times, just walked out. Now again, ask anybody who was in Auschwitz, but this is less of a miracle. Being on the stretcher when Mengele wants to give you an injection and you scream at him, on monkeys, not on you, because this is a smaller ness than if you are on lion's den and you escape from the lion. So the second time I was in the hands of Mengele, and Baruch Hashem, I was the second time saved. He would have just, he always carried with him a revolver, a pistol, and many times they shot on the spot, which I myself said that SS, he could have just, for such a thing, shoot. Not even sent to the gas chamber. Not do anything, just shoot on the spot.
Hindu just looked at me, bewildered, looked in astonishment on all other generals, and did not say one word. He just quietly, silently walked out. Somebody comes out from a lion's den, or somebody comes from a burning furnace. Rabbi Isaac, let me say one more, or two more episodes. And again, you judge whether this is anything natural or not natural. Afterwards, I went back to my bed, and I sent a letter to my father about this thing. The doctor comes back, and he says he can't find my father anymore. He's not in his barrack anymore. I became very, very nervous, telling him, please, you must locate my father. He said, but I know where he is. I said, I'm going to this bag, this bag, this barrack. He went all over. He cannot find. So I said, you must do it for me. You must find him. He went the third day back until he found out that there was a transport was taken from Auschwitz to Germany. My father was among these people who were taken from Auschwitz into Germany. When I heard this, it became with me an obsession. Since I don't know where my father is, I must find my mother, and I must find my sister. Now, you realize in Auschwitz, every lager was separated from another lager by electrical wires. You just couldn't go from one lager to another lager, just go through. First of all, the gates were all the SS with their guns. And from one lager to another lager, he could have been 25,000 Yidden, he could have been 25,000 Yidden. And like this, were hundreds of thousands, millions of Yidden in Auschwitz. But if you wanted to go from one lager to another lager, you couldn't, because there are electrical wires. As soon as you touched the wire, immediately became electrocuted on the spot, and you were dead. So how can you go searching in different lagers in Auschwitz? You search for a needle and a haystack. How do you find your mother and your sister? It became with me an obsession, I must do it. But first of all, I had to leave this Lager F. How can I leave the Lager F? So I had to make the scarlet fever, usually, until you know the whole skin peels off, usually takes between 5 or 6 weeks. This is maybe the fourth week. I decided I must leave. What did I do? I just started to pull off the skin. I was all over, you know, when the peel, it wasn't yet ready, the skin should come off, but I just pulled it. So all over, yes, it is bloody, you know, because it was just tearing into my flesh, pulled me this sores. Anyways, I also learned how you can make the temperature to go higher in a thermometer, and how you can make the temperature to go lower. You know, you kept rubbing it, the temperature goes higher. If you just, different how you bang it, see, the temperature goes lower. So although I could have 200, 203, when they came, the doctor came to measure my temperature, I always made it. I have 98, 99. Because I wanted to leave. And I left after 4 weeks. And I had to go work. It was the most difficult work in Auschwitz was what? And you had to carry from one lager to another lager. For example, they had to carry bricks, cinder blocks, cement. These big coaches. But they didn't have their horses or cows, never mind a truck. So we people had to carry it. How did we schlep it? So to this coach, this heavy big coach filled with bricks or cement, sand, cinder blocks, tremendously heavy. And we're speaking here in the month of October, November, December, heavy snows, and you know, the big wheels entered into this mud, onto the snow, couldn't pull. So attached wires, like 10 wires, 15 wires to this coach. Everybody had to put one wire on his shoulder, and we were pulling it, like 10 people. You just can imagine that night when we came back from work, the whole body was completely numb. We just couldn't move it from the pain. But this was the only type of work which afforded me the opportunity I should be able to go from one lager to another lager. And through this, I could be able to find out the people in the other lager. So this was the most difficult work in Auschwitz, and that's what I volunteered to do. I did it. I came to this lager, lager A, lager B, lager C, lager D, all these different lagers, to unload things in the coach. So I always used to ask one of the Yidlech there, you know, today you work for me, and tomorrow I'll work for you. So instead of I to do take off so many bricks or so many, I mean, shovel the cement, you do double, and I'll do it for you tomorrow. And while loading and unloading, I went from barrack to barrack. Every lager has also a little kitchen for the Yidden in this lager. So I went to this kitchen. Who worked in the kitchen? A Jewish woman. And they saw me. In Auschwitz, there were no children. Every child was killed. There was no children in Auschwitz. When they saw me, they fell on me, they kissed me, they hugged me, and they gave me everything because they reminded themselves, and they started to cry. Oh, they're Moshele, they're Yankele, you know, their own children. And they're crying. They remembered, they saw their children in me. In Auschwitz, nobody had any food. They gave me bread. Gave me salami, a whole bread, a whole loaf of bread. How could I smuggle it out? So how could you smuggle out bread? How could you smuggle salami? I got myself a big pair of pants. And when I had bread, two loaves of bread, three loaves of bread or salamis, I pulled it through a wire, put in my pants between my legs. Here in the pants, it shouldn't be visible. And the two legs that I pushed the bread. Imagine I had to walk like this, and mamish the SS, when we went through from one gate to another gate, they shouldn't notice it. It's almost the biggest, because you couldn't walk, you know, because this. But anyways, so Baruch Hashem, for our ship, so for me, afterwards, mamish got eaten. Nobody had any food. I had bread, and you just can imagine, such a loaf of bread. Without the slightest exaggeration, there are millions of Yidden who are Holocaust survivors, just ask them. Such a slice of bread, you should give nowadays somebody such a piece of diamond. Can you imagine how many carats can be worth millions of dollars? I can assure you, in Auschwitz, this slice of bread, this loaf of bread, was much more valuable, had greater worth, because this was our very life. And I had it. And I was looking and looking for my mother and for my sister, until I came to one lager. It was middle of January, and I found my sister. My mother was taken away to the evacuated to another lager into Germany, and I asked the ladies, did you hear among girls? I said, in this lager, in this barrack. I went to this barrack, mamish. The whole thing was only like 4 or 5 months that I saw my sister. I did not recognize her. You realize in the whole Auschwitz, when I came back from Auschwitz, my head didn't grow, my nails didn't grow. My sister, remember it says in when we say the kinos Tisha B'Av, when a brother met a sister, when he said, are you a human being or you are a demon? Mama, she did not look like a human being. Only did not have anything except the skin and the bones. No muscles, no color, no hair. When I looked at her, mamish, I didn't recognize her. And I said to her, Mangel, das Trudy? She said, yes. And I didn't recognize her. And I started to cry. So then she starts to speak loud to me. I recognize her voice, but her appearance I didn't recognize. So I told her, here you have a big slice. I had to run back already, because until I found her, because the this big truck, this coach was going, I had to go take it back. I gave her this big bread. Loaf bread, and I tell her, Imitation, next week I'll be here again, and then I'll bring you such a salami. You just can't imagine what it meant in Auschwitz. A salami like this, a loaf of bread. Next week was the evacuation, and I didn't see her in Auschwitz again. And then next week started, was in January, I think the 12th or the 13th, when the Russians were approaching Auschwitz, and the Germans, did not want to leave any trace of Auschwitz should be a testimony what the atrocities and barbarism what they perpetrated in Auschwitz. So they decided to take every person still has strength to go to Germany, to evacuate them to Germany, and those who cannot, they'll kill them on the spot in Auschwitz. My sister had because imagine when we came back from work at night, December, January, tremendously freezing weather. Okay, it's been like 25 below zero. because Auschwitz is up in the mountains, very, very cold. And they counted every day, every night, as counting if nobody escaped. And many times they left us stand outside in the sub-freezing temperature. And we didn't have anything, just our shoe without socks, standing for hours and hours. So my sister, her toes all got frozen, and we had to take it off for her. So she couldn't go, and she remained out in Auschwitz. And we came again a selection, who should be evacuated from Auschwitz, who should stay in Auschwitz. So they saw me, a little Ingele, tell me, you go with the weak people, the sick people who stay here in Auschwitz. We knew already what will be the fate of those who stay in Auschwitz, they'll kill out. So they put me there with those weak people, the sick people, and as the SS moved away, I just jumped back to the group which were destined to be evacuated. Where did I jump? It's a group of Ukrainian soldiers. Let me tell you how bad the SS were. Ukrainians are even more vicious anti-Semites than the SS. They were captives. They themselves don't have to be evacuated. But when they saw that I jumped from this line to be amongst them, they called over an SS. It says, this Jew, this Yevrei, you know, in Russia you say Yevrei, he belongs there. So the SS shouted to me, screamed, go back. And he took his rifle and the bat gave me a bang on my head. I saw all the stars. I went, of course, I had to go back. When the SS went away again, I knew I have nothing what to lose. He'll they kill everybody. They won't leave any remnant in Auschwitz. There should be any testimony. So I jumped back again, but a different group. I shouldn't jump into. You shouldn't run. I had to run a little bit further away, not to run into the group of the Ukrainians. But since I had to run a lengthier stretch. So I said, saw me. Same thing again, took the butts of this rifle and started to hit me. I should go back. I went back. And began, it was already at night, but with these floodlights, illuminated all the time. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people were evacuated from Auschwitz. As the march began, and we remained behind, so when I noticed, I had a second, when I thought the SS doesn't see me, I jumped, and I also marched on. What happened, now soon you'll see, what happened with those Eden who remained behind, my sister amongst them? They put them all into several barracks. A barrack itself could fill thousands of people in one barrack. They poured over the barracks gasoline, and they started to shoot to burn all the Jews who remained behind in Auschwitz, to burn them all alive. They exploded the gas chambers. They couldn't anymore gas them, kill them in the gas chambers. So that's how they wanted to burn them here alive. And that's what my sister told me. In the nick of time, as the barracks started to burn, the first tanks, or the first group of the Russian soldiers arrived in Auschwitz, put out the fire, and they saved them. They would come an hour later, half an hour later, the whole barrack would be engulfed already in fire. They were all burned alive. As they were shooting, they make the fire, and they poured gasoline over the barracks, and and the Russians put out the fires. And that's how she was saved. And I will be saved already at the end of the month of January. And actually, when was I liberated? May the 5th. And truly, as I said, in Auschwitz, for me, was like Gan Eden compared to all other places. When we knew already, a few weeks before, that we were going to be evacuated, so that I could go into all these various various camps, and I could go into all the kitchens, and all places they keep all the clothes of the Jews who came to Auschwitz. So what did I do? I said, here I have food.
Here I can get everything what I need. What will be next lager, I don't know. So I decided I'm going to get myself as much clothes as possible. I should be able to barter, exchange. So I put on the bracelet, literally 15 pairs of socks, these heavy socks, the heavy SS socks, you know, this wool socks. If you have 15 pairs of socks, what kind of shoe do you need? So I got myself an SS, such a big shoe, because I had 15, and you just can imagine, because what kind of shoes did we have? You know, they gave us, you know, that's like wooden boats, you know, like little boats for wood. And this was very difficult to, so if you had a pair of socks, it protected you a little bit. So it was, people would give away food because they had pains in their legs, they're walking. So I put on a 15 pairs of socks, a heavy SS shoe. I put on at least 12, 13 pairs of pants. Many, many shirts and many jackets. I looked a little bit like a football player, you know, in the how you call it, the World Cup, how you call it? Those, you know, like, that's a Super Bowl. That's how I walked, you know. And we were walking, marching. And I thought, I'll have, when I'll need something, I'll be able to exchange, barter. Someone needs a pair of socks, give you a piece of bread. You need a pair of pants, I'll give you a pair of pants. I'm a wholesaler, I had everything there. But this was, to a certain extent, my undoing. As from Auschwitz to Germany, it's tremendous mountains. Very cold. The real winter season, January, February, March, tremendously cold. And up a mountain, down a mountain. Can you imagine, you march day in and day out without giving you any food? What did we eat? But hundreds of thousands of years, this was called this infamous march from Auschwitz to Germany. And hundreds of thousands of Jews are marching. So the only thing which we ate, this muddy snow, because, you know, so many people marched, this mud, but we didn't get anything what to eat. You just can't imagine the strength of a person. Over a week, just we ate this muddy snow. As I was marching up a mountain, down a mountain, I became so exhausted I couldn't carry anything. So I started to throw off everything. So first came off all my jackets. So I made with one jacket. All my shirts, I made with one shirt. All my pants, all on. Then I sat just up a mountain, not sleeping, not eating. So I started to throw off all the socks also. And in my childish mind, I didn't realize what will be. I have such a big shoe. The fissile, you know, the foot is so small. How can I march? But I didn't realize it. But I threw away all the socks. And because I wanted to make it, we all smell it through and through. And I started to just walk, but the hole was too big for my foot. So as I was putting down the shoe in the snow, the shoe remained in the snow and my foot came out. So I couldn't walk anymore, so I had to push it. I couldn't pick up the shoe, I had to push the shoe in the snow. Heavy leather, you know, these SS shoes, this heavy, heavy leather. And I kept on pushing with my feet the shoe until it ate away the whole flesh, until literally my bone was exposed. Even now you can see a little line, a little scar, just a big hole. And it was, you could see that the mud and the blood and this, the snow, the muddy snow, and you could see the bone. It just ate away the whole flesh. Because it's heavy leather, like us eating day in, day out, just pushing it. And I mummish, I couldn't walk anymore. The pains was excruciating. You just undescribable these pains. My leg was numb, and the pain was tremendous. I just couldn't walk. But let me tell you one thing before. We used to march a whole day. At night, they used to let us lay down for a few hours. Marching up and down, we were sweated through and through. How do we lay down in the open fields on what? On snow. Just ask any normal person. Sleep in a sub-freezing temperature. The only thing which you have, you don't have a blanket, you don't have a sheet. You only lay on your wet, sweated through shirt. You lay down in the sub-freezing temperature on snow. I can testify, I've never seen one person should not get up in the morning, should be freeze to death. How can such a thing be? And asked, there were hundreds of thousands of people in this infamous march. If they saw not a sore throat, not pneumonia, not influenza, simply if you sleep in a sub-freezing temperature with a wet shirt on snow for a few hours, you should not get up anymore. You freeze to death. I've never seen one such a thing. It possibly happened. But I tell you, it wasn't a normal occurrence. Maybe one in a thousand, 100,000. I've never seen it. You need a less of a miracle, those who survived. Medically, explain such a thing. Impossible to explain. Nobody was sick. And simply, why didn't we die and freeze to death? Every night we slept a few hours, 4 hours, 5 hours, this tremendously freezing temperature. Soon I'll tell you how cold it was. And nobody ever remained sleeping forever in the snow. And it's not something which I say that I make it up. Just ask all the survivors who went in this. Hundreds of thousands of people went in this evacuation from Auschwitz to Germany. How can you account for such a thing? If it's not HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Medically. And we have a number of doctors. So we can ask the doctor if medically there is such explanation. Anyways, Rabbi Isai, I simply couldn't walk anymore. My pains was absolutely unbearable. I couldn't walk. The Germans were so punctual, as you know, the Jeckers. The line we could see many times, if it's a clear day and up a mountain, for miles on, like a string of people, but one thing, not like people went all over. It has to be, if anybody moved out a few centimeters, a few inches from the line, immediately was shot. So you can see on this big evacuation on both sides, a little piles of people who were shot. If anybody just moved out a little bit, immediately was shot. So sometimes I think to myself, I cannot take it anymore. My pains are so unbearable. I won't be able to endure it anyways. Why torture yourself any further? And just move out from the line and fish will be shot. You get over with. But always something, which I'll tell you later on. And so at once I made up my mind, that's it. I cannot do it anymore. In this moment comes over to me a person who was maybe 17, 18 years old. It starts with our conversation. In Auschwitz, especially in this death march, everybody was only thinking about himself. How can he save himself? Nobody thought about anybody else. It was just a matter of survival. And you know, according to Darwin, the survival of the fittest. We only tried how we can survive another day. Suddenly this person comes over to me and starts a conversation. The whole time nobody spoke to me and nobody spoke to anybody else. Anybody only was thinking about himself. How can he save himself? How can he survive? And what does he tell me? That he's one of the twins on whom Mengele made an experiment. So that's why he's still alive. He wasn't sent into the gas chamber. And what does he tell me? He comes from the same city where I come from. So we are in defense. So I tell him, but I have such a pace, I just cannot walk. She tells me, no problem. Just put your hands on my shoulder and I'll help you walk. For the next day or two, I was just hopping on my right foot and he was holding me like this. That's how it was, because my left foot was completely out of commission. I just simply couldn't walk anymore. Couldn't do anything with it. But can you imagine, you hop with one foot the whole time. Anyways, so he was helping me. Suddenly, when I decided, that's it, I can't go anymore. I'll just move out, I'll be shot, you're finished. So this person comes over and he starts with the conversation. And someone should be concerned about somebody else. In this death march, everybody was only thinking about himself. How can he survive? Someone should be concerned about somebody else. Anyway, this person started, says, put your hands on me. And he was helping me to go. The bicep was going, I was hopping like this for 2 days, maybe 3 days. But my last ounce of strength was gone. We didn't have anything but to eat. Only this muddy snow. Here, the foot hurts me. Not hurting is not an expression. It just was unbearable. And here I was absolutely exhausted, hungry, weak. So again, I decide, what's the use of just torturing yourself further? I won't be able to survive. It's impossible. So I tell him, I'll move out from this line, and the assess will see that I moved off the line, but then I have to be everything is so straight and punctual. And I finish, I get over with the whole tsaris. As I made up my mind firmly that I'm just moving out, suddenly an SS comes over to me. And this SS starts with me a conversation. Because I told you my mother tongue was German, so I could speak German. And he starts with me a conversation. And asking where I come from, who is my family, what did my father do, and he inquired about everything. I saw this person has a little sympathy for me, so I tell him, Herr SS-man, Mr. SS, I'm so weak, I cannot take it anymore. Maybe you have to get, you can give me something. He takes off his canteen, off his belt, and opens up the canteen and gives me good, hot, sweet, black coffee. Rabbi Isai, when you say the Jew of revival, the Hashem is going to make the Tchias amazing through the Jew called Tal Tchia. If you want to, if anybody can have a taste, what does it mean? Dal Tchia, the revives. This was this Jew of revival. I finished in one gulp this black sugar, sweet coffee. It mamish revived me. And giving back the canteen, he speaks with me a little longer, and this SS, just like I didn't see where he came from, I did not see how he disappeared. Finished. His SS is gone. It gave me strength for a few hours, but a few hours later, again, I cannot. I'm weak. What do you think for the next few days, 4 or 5 days, every few hours this SS appears and starts with me a conversation, and every time after a few words I ask him, do you have anything for me? He gives me his canteen and mamish is machaya mesi. One particular time we reached a very high mountain. It was exceedingly cold. My ears were mamish freezing, and the SS comes to me again, the conversation, and by that time he knew already not only all my members of my family, my babes, my uncles, and I knew everybody about my business, my father, everything. He knew everything about our family. Then I tell him, you know, my ears are freezing, I just simply cannot take it. So what do you think? He takes off his SS cap, puts it on my head, pulls it down on my ears, covers my ears with his SS cap, and he goes bareheaded, and I walk with the SS cap. And believe me, I don't exaggerate, I only tell you the MS Lamitoy. I never see when this person, when this SS came, I never saw when this SS disappeared, meant. Once he comes to me, and he speaks and speaks and speaks. By the last few days, I didn't have to ask him. He immediately gives me the canteen with the coffee. He suddenly speaks like a few minutes, like 5 minutes, and he doesn't offer me the coffee. So I ask him, where is the coffee? He tells me, this time I myself also don't have the coffee anymore. We don't have even the SS don't have coffee anymore. So I tell him, if that's the case, let me just move out and shoot him. I cannot take it. He starts to plead with me. And he says, please just endure. You'll go back, you'll see your father, you'll go back, you'll see your mother, you'll be still a happy person, don't give up. But I tell him, I cannot. So what do you think? I was just hopping over my holding the shoulders, by this time my good friend, and he, this SS, holds me my right arm, and he says, 6 kilometers from here, we'll come to our village,
I'll go to one of the German families, their houses, and I'll get you coffee. But just please don't give up. I said, but I cannot. So he was holding me by my right arm, my left side, my other, one of the twins. And that's how we came. We arrived in this village. He rented a German house, and he brought me coffee. But this time it was no more black coffee, sweet coffee, just plain black coffee. I drank it. That's what he had. I drank out this canteen of black coffee. Then he asks me back for his cap. And this time he needs back the cap. I gave him back the cap. And he went away. I never saw this SS again. We came to Linz, a city in Austria. And I don't know what happened to this SS, but I never seen him again. When I came back from Auschwitz, came back to Czechoslovakia as a child, I still remember everything very, very vividly, but I wanted to write down everything what happened from 1941, when my grandparents were taken, till the day of my liberation, when the Americans liberated our camp, Gunskirchen. So I started to write. I wrote everything until my father, what happened to my father. Afterwards, I just couldn't write anymore. And I decided I'm going to continue it some other time, and I'll be able to write with my father also. But I wrote this chapter in this infamous, or this death march from Auschwitz to Germany. So we describe this episode with this SS. In this chapter, I wrote in more detail than I'm telling it to you here now. I finish off this chapter as follows. Who indeed was this German? Knowing who were the SS whom they sent Hitler to take care, in quotation marks, over the Jews, the most vicious, most cruelest, most callous criminals, truly the scum of the earth. They did not have any compassion, any mercy. Said we would have a greater mercy on an end which crossed on the ground, then they would have mercy or compassion on a Jew. Who was this SS? Was it truly an SS, or he was a Malach disguised as an SS soldier? And then I mentioned there are many times when the Hashem sent an angel, Malach Michoel, Ayanovi, different Malach Refoel, to save Eden. But they indeed, and as the Talmud says, many times they come disguised as human beings. So I finished off this chapter. Maybe, because knowing who the Germans were, it wasn't a human being altogether. It cannot be a German. Maybe it was an angel that Hashem sent to save an innocent little child. And then I continue. Even let's assume it was a German. Not a Malach. A German should have Rachmonis on a child. He should encourage him, don't give up. You'll still come back to your home. You'll still see your family. You'll still have a happy life. Takes off his cap. Gives me his coffee. He holds him by his hand. A German, really, as I said, the most vicious people. He should have compassion and mercy on a Jew is not less of a miracle than an angel comes. Rabbi Isai, I could go on and on and on. This is only, I didn't mention yet, so we came to Mauthausen, which is even a more terrible concentration camp, extermination camp than Auschwitz. And others with Melk and Gunskirchen. But I think it'll suffice. I can go on and on. Yes, you yourself should judge. If I'm here today, it was just a coincidence, but only good luck, whatever name you apply to it. Or if a person should be just truthful, objective. If you don't see here the hand of God, and just like with this little innocent child who speaks to you right now, the Eibishter that helped him, he should survive. No less of miracles, no fewer miracles, not smaller miracles, It's like a Baruch Hu show to every person came out from this burning crucible, Auschwitz, and the other death and exhibition camps. If a person asks you, where was God? And especially a Holocaust survivor will ask you, where was God? Tell him God was with you. If not, if God wouldn't be with you, you wouldn't be able to be here today and ask this very question. Except some people out of sufferings, which I'm going to discuss in Shem next week, don't want to face reality. Some people, like a hostage, just bury their heads and don't want to see. For some people it's easier, or for a reason which we'll discuss in such next week, because some people don't want to face this reality. But truly, truly, not one person survived Auschwitz without Hashem.